Two religions have shaped the experience of Southern Baptists since the 1870s. The older religion was the evangelical orthodoxy represented by such denominational leaders as Richard Furman, Jesse Mercer, and Basil Manley Sr. The newer religion was the liberalism that emerged in America in the late 19th century. In the 20th century, the liberalism grew in strength and came to dominate the faculties of Southern Baptist seminaries and college religion departments. The Southern Baptist Theological Seminary played a critical role in the careers of both religions. The seminary began promoting the liberal religion around 1900. By the 1940s, the seminary's faculty consisted largely of liberals, and the school constituted the headwaters of most of the denomination's liberalism. But throughout its history, the seminary functioned also as a bulwark of traditional orthodoxy in the denomination. James P. Boyce made it his ambition to establish a seminary dedicated to the preservation and transmission of evangelical orthodoxy, and therefore implanted an orthodox creed, the abstract of principles, at its center, including the requirement that faculty be dismissed for departure from its principles. And when Boyce enforced the orthodoxy by dismissing a beloved professor and enlisted the seminary in a battle against the liberal view of the Bible's inspiration, he established a precedent that endured in denominational memory throughout the 20th century. The abstract of principles and that precedent stood as powerful symbols of sound religion and left a durable impression on denominational identity. The relationship between these two religions determined the basic shape of the denomination in the 20th century. They existed in a strange and delicate balance as liberals and traditionalists worked together in important ways, but at the same time worked against each other. Southern Seminary was the guardian of this uneasy alliance. Its presidents and faculty secured the balance by a policy of denominational realism. They needed to maintain the trust of the denomination's orthodox majority, and so they exercised a vigilant self-censorship over their progressive convictions. Only thus could they possess the seminary as a platform for the gradual advance of liberalism in the denomination. The realistic policy supported a modus vivendi that endured nearly 100 years and permitted the liberals to become a powerful minority in the denomination. When the policy finally failed in the late 20th century, the majority traditionalists drove the liberals from their denominational posts. Now, the liberalism that became strong among Southern Baptists was not the liberalism so brilliantly described by Westminster Theological Seminary founder J. Gresham Machen. In his classic 1923 work, Christianity and Liberalism, Machen argued that liberalism and Christianity were different religions. Liberalism, Machen said, is not Christianity. It was, in fact, entirely different from Christianity. Liberalism, Machen said, was a vague religious naturalism, whereas Christianity was a supernatural religion. Machen developed a powerful theological critique of the presuppositions and arguments of liberal religion. But Machen defined liberalism largely in terms of where its positions logically led. He thus described liberals as they ought to be, more than as they actually were. Most liberals, in fact, set themselves against naturalism. They revised the Christian religion in fundamental ways, but the revision gained popularity in American Christianity because most liberal leaders believed deeply in God's personal activity in human affairs. Machen's schema certainly did not describe the kind of liberalism that prospered as a minority movement among Southern Baptists since the late 19th century. Southern Baptist liberals did not reject supernaturalism, though they often limited its scope. They held to the necessity of redemption through faith in Christ, though they tended to reject penal views of the atonement. At the center of Southern Baptist liberalism was the acceptance of a liberal view of inspiration in an effort to construct a form of Christianity consistent with evolution and scientific historical criticism. Liberals developed a new version of Christianity in an effort to meet the threat of scientific naturalism. And scientific naturalism appeared to threaten the overthrow of traditional Christianity. Developments in science and in history in the 19th century seemed to contradict the fundamental claims of the Bible. The science of geology embraced gradualist, uniformitarian models and overthrew belief in a young earth. In biology, Darwin's theory of gradual evolution of species displaced belief in the immediate creation of species by the power of God. And a new historical science presupposed that human culture, like species, advanced by gradual evolution. And this included religion. This discredited the belief that the Jewish religion appeared suddenly at Mount Sinai in the desert. Rather, the law of Moses must have developed over many centuries. The presuppositions of the new historical science underlay the historical critical method, which thoroughly reconstructed Jewish and Christian history in a way that contradicted the Bible's historical statements. This reconstructed history required extensive reinterpretation of the Bible. The historical critical method was, in fact, a philosophy of history, and its anti-supernatural presuppositions led it to distrust the Bible's supernatural claims. Many scholars and Christians concluded, therefore, that if the new science was true, then the Bible was filled with fables. Its creation account was a myth, its portrayal of the giving of the law of Moses, replete with elaborate systems of ritual, sacrifice, and law, was a pious fraud. The New Testament accounts of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection also were partially fabulous. If the new science was true, then Christianity was false. This presented a stark alternative. Those who accepted the new science and the new history rejected the Bible and its message. Those who accepted the Bible's message rejected the new science and history. Liberals rejected the alternatives. They developed a third way. They deliberately constructed a form of Christianity that accepted the new science and the new history, but rejected their naturalistic conclusions. They were convinced of the truth of the new science and history, but they refused to abandon the Bible and the Christian faith. They accepted most of the new science and history and accepted the essential elements of the traditional faith. And so liberals saw their construction of Christianity as the true antidote to scientific naturalism. Liberalism was a middle way. Its mediating character largely defined it. It would embrace both science and the Bible. But liberalism's middle way proved unstable. Liberals developed a wide variety of different approaches, combining the new science and traditional Christian truth, but the presuppositions of the two did not readily cohere. And the various systems constructed to hold them together tended to fly apart, like pressing together the like poles of two magnets. The brilliance of Machen's analysis of liberalism lay in his recognition of this essential tension. Liberals, too, recognized the tension, but they were not embarrassed by it. It was not alien to liberalism, they felt. It was rather intrinsic. They chose to establish liberalism on the tension. And many liberals recognized, even as Machen did, that they were uniting incommensurable epistemologies. Naturalistic presuppositions ruled science, including the new scientific history. And supernaturalistic presuppositions ruled religion. But the liberals trusted that they could establish or discover a deeper unity that would somehow connect and bridge the two. Most found the bridge in the doctrine of God's immanence in the world's historical process. Machen correctly concluded that liberalism was a different kind of religion than traditional Christianity, but it was historically unhelpful to identify liberalism with naturalism. Liberalism did embrace some naturalistic presuppositions, but it held them in tension with supernaturalistic presuppositions. Christianity and liberalism were indeed two religions, but both opposed naturalism. In the Southern Baptist Convention, liberalism was restrained by a conservative constituency and by Southern seminaries' foundational commitment to orthodoxy. These kept the mediating character of Southern Baptist liberalism intact for several generations, holding in tension its commitment to science and the Bible. It had, however, to adopt a new view of the Bible's inspiration to accomplish this task. Before the 20th century, Southern Baptist liberals were few. They were mostly young ministers trained at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. In the early 1880s, the denomination experienced considerable controversy concerning liberalism's foundational doctrine, its new view of inspiration. This initial liberal movement among Southern Baptists originated largely through the influence of Crawford H. Toy, who began teaching Old Testament at Southern Seminary in 1869. By the early 1870s, Toy embraced uniformitarian geology and Darwinian evolution. He could no longer harmonize the Bible and science. If evolutionary views of geology and biology were correct, Toy concluded, then the Genesis history of the origin of the earth and of living things was false. And for some time, he could not reconcile Genesis with the accepted science. And he naturally feared the consequences. What then, Toy thought, would become of the Bible, its truthfulness, its helpfulness? He could not repudiate the new science, but he was loath to give up the Bible. Around 1875, he solved the problem. He reconciled science and the Bible by practically divorcing the divine and human aspects of the Bible. The divine aspect was the internal spiritual meaning inspired by the Holy Spirit. The human aspect was the human language of the text, its literal meaning. He so divided the Bible's outward meaning from its inward that its outward meaning could be false while its inward meaning was true. He held that the Bible was wholly true then because it was true in its real meaning, that is, in its spiritual intent, even though its historical human assertions were often in error. The Bible then employed the primitive thought forms of the day to convey its inner spiritual truths. Genesis was wrong as science, but true as religion. It erred on the when and the how of creation, but it was right on who was behind it. With this new approach in hand, he could embrace the scientific claims of gradualist geology and Darwinian evolution wholeheartedly, and at the same time retain his faith in a Bible that was true in its spiritual meaning. The new view of inspiration permitted liberal scholars to apply the anti-supernaturalistic methods of scientific criticism of the Bible without rejecting supernaturalism in religion. It was a special case of Kant's empirical method. It surrendered the outward phenomena to scientific skepticism in order to preserve the inward noumenal realities of the text. Liberal scholars accepted the rationalist criticisms of the Bible, but they argued that this affected only its outward form, its historical clothing or husk. The inward reality, the spiritual kernel, remained eternally true. This new view of inspiration was critical to liberalism, but Toy and his followers did not initially win wide acceptance of it within the Southern Baptist Convention. After about 1900, however, most of the faculty at Southern Seminary adopted the new view and quietly promoted it. By the middle of the 20th century, most of the denomination's seminary professors and college religion professors took the new view for granted. The election of Edgar Y. Mullins as president of Southern Seminary in 1899 represented a new era in Southern Baptist history. He transformed Baptist theology and Baptist identity extensively. And he gave leadership to denominational progressives who embraced the new view of inspiration and sought to inculcate a more salubrious liberal religion among Southern Baptists. As a result, progressive theology flourished at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary for most of the 20th century. Mullins' own religion was a form of progressive religion, which may be called, for lack of a better term, evangelical liberalism. Mullins and his fellow progressives intended to reform the faith through proper regard for science, individualism, and progress. The progressive religion would, they believe, provide a more adequate response to modern intellectual challenges to the faith and afford greater motive for personal holiness and social service. Yale University literary critic Harold Bloom insightfully characterized Mullins as the founder of a new progressive religion among Southern Baptists. He called Mullins the refounder of the Southern Baptist religion. Mullins introduced a subjective and experiential faith and initiated a new phase of Southern Baptist history. Mullins, Bloom said, devised a distinctly American religion that so redefined traditional Protestantism that it could scarcely be called Christianity. Bloom characterized Mullins' new faith variously as mysticism, Gnosticism, and enthusiasm, though not as naturalism. Mullins was the first Southern Seminary president to develop the realistic policy designed to protect liberal faculty members and to afford them an opportunity for a gradual introduction of liberal ideas among the churches. Mullins was the first who needed the policy, since the faculty began to embrace liberalism during his tenure. Professors Charles S. Gardner, Jesse B. Weatherspoon, Harold W. Tribble, and especially W. O. Carver cautiously promoted liberal theology among the seminary students. Mullins was confident that commitment to progressive ideas would grow, even among Southern Baptists. Progress was inevitable, Mullins said, but it would have to be slow progress among Southern Baptists. We will, Mullins said, undoubtedly continue to go forward, because all the modern educational conditions favor progress, but we will have to go slowly beyond a doubt. Genuine denominational progress, he said, would require perfect patience. Mullins and his progressive colleagues adopted a realistic approach to reforming the denomination. If they pressed for rapid change, they risked alienating the very constituency they sought to reform. Now, these progressives chafed and grew restive at times under these constraints, but they could not evade their necessity. The faculty had to be realistic. They had to face the facts, which meant a realistic appraisal of where the mass of Southern Baptists stood and where they could be led. The realistic approach meant teaching the denomination they had, not the denomination they wanted. Shaler Matthews, a leading liberal theologian at the University of Chicago Divinity School and a veteran of Northern denominational reform efforts, explained the realistic approach this way. Matthew said, "Education has to begin where people are, not where they ought to be. If this be recognized, conflict between the progressive and the reactionary elements in religious thought may not be avoided, but it will at least be postponed long enough to make some type of cooperation between the two elements possible. Whether or not one calls it compromise, cooperation between liberals and conservatives will always be in the direction of the liberals. Progress may be slow, but one has to take a long view of social process. And then it is certain. Those who take a realistic view of progress through cooperation rather than through conflict must be educators rather than agitators. And education demands patience." Matthews's description was also the blueprint for Southern Seminary's progressives. And they followed it for most of the 20th century. And it was the policy of realistic denominational relations. The commitment to a realistic denominational diplomacy was in some ways little more than a conspiracy of circumspection. From the beginning of his presidency, Mullins understood the necessity of the realist approach. His predecessor, William H. Whitsitt, had waged an idealistic crusade for the faculty's academic freedom, and in consequence, Southern Baptists forced him to resign. Whitsitt's idealistic crusade had damaged the seminary's reputation and diminished its effectiveness as an agency of reform. The faculty now needed to censor themselves in order to avoid alarming the churches and losing their trust. The realist policy required progressive Southern Baptist leaders to develop two sets of sympathies. They generally accommodated their language to the orthodox views of the people, But among the like-minded, they spoke in a more progressive tongue. To many of the Orthodox, this ambidextrous approach seemed dishonest. Some progressive leaders felt the same way. But the most effective leaders in the denomination were masters of this approach. Southern Baptist scholars lived in the tension then between the progressive religion and the traditional orthodoxy of the denomination. To succeed in these two worlds, they had to develop a double consciousness, knowing when to speak the language of traditional orthodoxy and when to speak the language of progressive religion. When speaking to the Orthodox, they kept their progressive commitments hidden behind a veil. But to succeed in promoting liberal ideas, they needed to open the veil cautiously at times to trusted students and pastors. It was a difficult skill to master. When progressive scholars opened the veil too far and revealed too much, they risked losing their positions and their influence. They longed to educate Southern Baptists in the truths of the new science and of the scientific historical criticism of the Bible. They believed that the future of religion was along this path. But more important, they believed that Christianity would wither and die unless Christians adapted the faith to these truths. The new progressive religion alone could defend the faith successfully in the modern world. And the new progressive religion alone could inject it with a new vitality and attract a new generation of modern persons into the church. Promoting liberalism, therefore, was essential to their calling. After World War II, the number of progressive faculty at the seminary increased significantly. And so did their frustration at the necessity of keeping their liberal convictions largely hidden from public view. Southern Baptists, they saw, were not making progress toward a more liberal faith. Wayne Oates, who afterward became one of the most recognized professors at the seminary, was horrified as a student in 1943 that Southern Seminary's professors taught the old Orthodox approach to the Bible and ignored modern historical critical scholarship. Oates had learned to interpret the Bible based on historical criticism at Wake Forest College. And Oates held that the old pre-critical methods were completely rotten and could not equip students for relevant ministry. Most of Southern Seminary's courses, Oates complained, served up the students canned putrefaction. But few liberal professors sought to enlighten their students. He singled out Harold Tribble, Jesse Weatherspoon, and Gaines Dobbins as the few promoters of liberal scholarship on the faculty. But Oates thought that it was a losing battle because President Ellis Fuller stifled liberalism in the seminary. Oates recognized that the abstract of principles hemmed in the faculty and prevented them from expressing their liberal ideas more openly because Fuller took seriously the requirement that all professors agree with the seminary's creed and because Fuller did not trust the faculty's independence. And although Tribble, Oates thought, was doing wonderful work, he had to blast away at old conceptions before he could even begin to teach the scientific approach to the Bible. Oates concluded, finally, that Tribble was trying to sweep the ocean back with a broom. Bob Lassiter, another Wake Forest graduate and a fellow student with Oates, felt the same way. He complained to Wake Forest religion professor Olin T. Binkley that he was dissatisfied with the dogmatism and the closed minds that he found at Southern Seminary. He believed that Tribble and Weatherspoon were doing their best to overcome the faults elsewhere on the faculty, and he acknowledged that Gaines Dobbins was trying also, but he had to veil his thought over with so much generalization and introduction that most of the students missed the point altogether. Lassiter wanted to transfer to Yale Divinity School, where he could get a real education. Lassiter and Oates stayed at Southern, however, largely because Binkley, their former professor at Wake Forest College, agreed to join the faculty of Southern Seminary in 1944. And after he came, they concentrated their efforts on classes under Binkley, Tribble, and Weatherspoon. One of the costs of Southern Seminary's realistic policy was the loss of progressive students to Northern seminaries. Binkley was committed to promoting progressive views in the Southern Baptist Convention, but he was not always optimistic about the prospects. In 1939, he recognized that the ministerial students coming out of Wake Forest were liberal and would find little encouragement in Southern Baptist institutions. He predicted that the better students would increasingly get their theology degrees from Yale, Colgate-Rochester, Crozer, and Duke. Now, this had an advantage for progressive reformers. As such Northern Baptists as Shaler Matthews had learned, Binkley and other Southern Baptist progressives understood that they could not reform the denomination by open agitation in favor of their views. They would succeed only by changing the denominational mind gradually, by calm pedagogy rather than by direct confrontation. The conservative prejudices of the people and of their demagogues would prevent liberal ideas from gaining a fair and unbiased consideration in the denomination. Binkley was distressed and embarrassed by the conservative attitudes and utterances of Southern Baptist leaders. But he saw rays of light and hope in the fact that gifted ministerial students were getting a progressive theological education, even if it had to be at Northern seminaries. Binkley said, "We now have ministerial students who are going from our churches in this state, North Carolina, to Yale, Union, Colgate-Rochester, Andover Newton, Harvard, and Hartford for their theological training, and then come back as pastors to some of our churches and exhibit Christian attitudes and become centers of infection for intelligent religious living." Read liberal. H. Cornell Gorner, who taught missions at the seminary from 1938 to 1957, explained the strategy, the realistic policy, in 1943, to alumnus Paul Stagg, the brother of Frank Stagg. Stagg had complained that the seminary was failing to produce preachers who could speak relevantly to the modern world because they refused to teach in accordance with their liberal convictions. The professors pretended to be more conservative than they were, Stagg said, in order to please a reactionary and socially backward constituency. Stagg cited the fact that the professors were not teaching openly the assured findings of criticism in Old Testament classes, and that publicly they showed less enthusiasm for the ecumenical movement than they did privately in their classrooms. Gorner acknowledged the truth of Stagg's complaints. He answered that his approach was a deliberate strategy of small steps by which Southern Baptists could be educated gradually. Prudence and policy, Gorner said, argued for keeping silent regarding the most extreme convictions which one has. Sometimes, Gorner felt that one should cast caution to the winds and boldly declare what he believed about controversial matters, regardless of the consequences. But to publish such views would defeat the whole plan. Instead, Gorner wrote, "I am pursuing the path of education rather than revolution." Olin Binkley, before he came to Southern Seminary, declined election to the seminary's faculty in 1943, largely due to the fact that he felt he would not be free to teach the historical critical approach to biblical interpretation. He felt that he would have had less freedom at Southern than he had at Wake Forest. Bob Lassiter, the former student of Binkley's at Wake Forest, congratulated Binkley for rejecting Southern's invitation. "Since," Lassiter said, "at the seminary, you do not have freedom to teach as you please." Binkley himself explained to Yale Seminary's Luther Weigel that at Wake Forest, he could still teach large numbers of ministerial students, and he would have freedom within the liberal tradition here at Wake Forest. When Binkley changed his mind the following year and accepted a position at Southern Seminary, he recognized the necessity of the realistic policy. But he longed for freedom to teach critical views openly. "I have often prayed," Binkley said, "in lonely hours for the privilege of studying and teaching in a school which provided freedom and fellowship and encouragement to achieve a vital union of critical intelligence and religious devotion." That was his shorthand phrase for liberalism, critical intelligence and religious devotion. He found the necessary limitations on his freedom so onerous that he planned to leave the seminary at his first opportunity. He wanted to escape the resistance to Christian scholarship which he endured there. But most of the faculty members saw the necessity of a realistic approach. In order to have a hearing among the churches And perhaps, in order even to retain the position on the faculty, they could not afford to arouse the opposition of their conservative denomination. They had to be satisfied with gradual progress. Many of the faculty nevertheless wanted to introduce modern scholarship into the ordinary teaching course at the seminary. They felt that pastors needed to be educated in the latest scholarship, which meant interpreting the Bible according to the canons of historical criticism. The current curriculum introduced almost none of the methods and conclusions of modern scholarship and emphasized memorization and the transmission of traditional orthodoxy rather than the critical scholarship of liberalism. The faculty felt that they needed greater freedom of expression. Unless they had some opportunity to advance their progressive ideas, however cautiously, Southern Baptists would be relegated forever to fighting rearguard actions of increasing irrelevance in a culture that was progressing in education, science, and social relations. Southern Baptist churches would sacrifice their influence in society and miss their God-given opportunity to lead the South into a more just and equitable society. During Ellis Fuller's presidency in the 1940s, some faculty members began introducing historical criticism into the classroom. They had to do so in measured doses and with great caution because Fuller opposed it. When Clyde Francisco, for example, taught a course on the historical criticism of the Pentateuch, Fuller evidently told him that the seminary had no business offering such a course. In other classes afterward, Francisco treated historical criticism as merely parenthetical introduction with no impact on interpretation at all. Harold Tribble, theology professor at the seminary from 1925 to 1947, tried to convince Fuller that the seminary faculty needed to be free to teach modern scholarship, to expose students to its conclusions in order that they might learn to think independently and become responsible and creative leaders in the denomination. Under Fuller's administration, Tribble felt the school operated as a promotional program of the convention rather than as a graduate school committed to the ideals and techniques of true education. Again, when you read true education, it means modern historical critical scholarship. He urged Fuller to grant freedom on the part of the faculty to do a creative job, which meant freedom to teach liberal scholarship. Only this approach would produce the courageous and creative leadership Binkley felt that the Southern Baptist Convention desperately needed. Tribble felt. But Fuller refused. Tribble believed that Fuller was interested primarily in preserving the seminary's popularity with the convention at the expense of truth and of effective theological education. But Fuller believed that historical criticism was, at best, irrelevant to effective preaching, teaching, and pastoral ministry. Fuller also felt that it was unrealistic to expect Southern Baptists to support a seminary that taught historical critical premises and conclusions as true. The older progressives like Tribble, Binkley, and Weatherspoon did not disagree with the policy of denominational realism. They recognized the practical impossibility of any professor teaching openly that such miracles as the virgin birth of Jesus or his walking on the water were not exactly the historical facts that the Bible claimed they were. There were similar obstacles to teaching that Moses did not write the Pentateuch or that Daniel was actually written in the 2nd century before Christ rather than the 6th. But they wanted freedom to teach their students to grapple with such possibilities. And they wanted to relieve such conclusions from the prejudice of being labeled heretical. This, at least, would provide for some progress. But unlike Fuller, they wanted to move the denomination toward acceptance of modern historical critical scholarship. They believed, with the older liberals generally, that the way to reform the denomination was not by sudden revolution, but by gradual teaching. Students, instructed properly in modern scholarship, would go out into the churches and exercise leadership in a gradual reformation of the denomination. For this reason, progressive faculty urged the establishment of a strong research doctoral program in which a select cadre of gifted students could be trained in modern scholarship. Such a program would provide Southern Baptists with leaders capable of influencing the churches in a more progressive direction. When Tribble realized that Fuller would never permit this kind of freedom, He left Southern Seminary for the freer atmosphere of Andover Newton Theological Seminary in Massachusetts, and then finally of Wake Forest University, where he had opportunity to give leadership, he said, in directing the thought life of our state through our graduates. Duke K. McCall, who succeeded Fuller in 1951, earned a reputation as a fundamentalist leader when he led trustees to fire 13 professors in 1958. Conservatives and liberals throughout the denomination interpreted the firings as a purge of liberalism at the seminary. It was not. McCall did not object to the theology of the 13, nor to their commitment to historical criticism. Rather, at the center of the conflict was McCall's insistence that the faculty conform their teaching to the realist policy of denominational relations. They were insisting instead on freedom. McCall aimed to secure the faculty's freedom to teach their progressive views, but to do this, he had at the same time to reassure Southern Baptists that the faculty was sound in doctrine. McCall referred to this as achieving a, quote, balance between freedom for progressive teaching and the need to keep the critics quiet. The balance between freedom for progressive teaching and the need to keep the critics quiet. This was the only realistic approach to the seminary's relationship with the conservative denomination. A great deal of McCall's efforts, in fact, went toward keeping the faculty within the limits of this policy of denominational realism. Ironically, McCall's sterling reputation as an orthodox fundamentalist, earned by the firings, afforded him a position of considerable strength from which to manage the realistic policy. Student Robert McCann was disarmingly frank in his description of McCall's realistic diplomacy. In 1955, McCann said, "Dr. McCall talks one way when he is visiting churches and another way here at the seminary. However, I feel that he is trying to give the more liberal views in the seminary a chance to take hold." The dismissal of the 13 convinced Southern Baptists of McCall's orthodoxy, and this afforded more freedom for the seminary to provide leadership for denominational progress and liberal scholarship. As long as the seminary's reputation remained sound, its position would be strong enough to promote a more progressive theology. The realistic constraints nevertheless remained, and one careless act of theological aggression could upset the entire arrangement. But as long as faculty minded their diplomatic manners, McCall gave them freedom to develop and promote their modern theology. Since McCall's 1958 purge, Southern Baptists seemed to have a renewed trust in the soundness of the seminaries. And liberal professors throughout the convention felt a relaxing of the constraints. At New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary, New Testament professor Frank Stagg was pleasantly surprised in 1959, the year after the firing of the 13 at Southern Seminary, to discover that President Leo Edelman stood for freedom. Stagg said, "Edelman has dispelled the fears many of us had, and he is proving to be the best champion for freedom and scholarship that we have had in a long time. He has shown understanding and given new courage to some of the men who for too long have been badgered by the defenders of a borrowed faith." In the same year, New Orleans professor Ted Clark published a book called Saved by His Life, an interpretation of the Christian faith along neo-Orthodox and Tillichian lines. Clark argued that belief in an infallible or inerrant Bible, when the Bible is looked upon as the very Word of God, was a form of idolatry. He argued also that the church had distorted the Jesus of history into the myth of Jesus the Son of God in the second person of the Trinity. He rejected the doctrine of eternal punishment in favor of annihilationism. And he argued that early Christians gave undue prominence to the cross. In 1961, Ralph Elliott, professor of Old Testament at Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary and formerly at Southern Seminary, published The Message of Genesis, in which he relied on historical critical premises to discount the historical reliability of such biblical passages as creation, flood, the sacrifice of Isaac, and Joseph's interpretation of dreams in favor of their ostensible spiritual meaning. Also in 1961, the Southern Baptist Convention's pastor conference, the premier venue for Southern Baptist preachers, gave great hope to Southern Baptist liberals as the presence on the platform of Dale Moody and Carlisle Marney made it the most progressive and controversial lineup in memory. At about the same time, the Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary hired three New Testament professors, R.C. Briggs, Harold Oliver, and William Strickland, who taught their subject in close sympathy with Rudolf Bultmann's demythologizing approach. It seemed indeed a new day for progressive scholarship in the Southern Baptist Convention. But the liberals' Prague Spring did not last long. Conservative leaders in the denomination soon called for a crackdown. Clark and Eliot had neglected the self-censorship of the realist diplomacy and had awakened Southern Baptists to the fact that a few more liberals had infiltrated the seminaries. Many Southern Baptists feared that unless there was another purge, our denomination is headed for disaster. The seminary presidents generally wanted to support their faculty's freedom, but pressure from the churches forced them to purge a few liberal professors. New Orleans's Leo Edelman fired Clark in 1960. After a year of intense denominational controversy, Midwestern trustees fired Eliot in 1962. And after several years of wrenching internal controversy, Southeastern trustees forced out their Bultmannians in 1965. Some wanted McCall to fire Professors Dale Moody and Eric Rust for their liberalism. But McCall had already earned his stripes in 1958, and he withstood the pressure. The seminary faculty supported the theological perspectives of their martyred colleagues, Clark, Eliot, Moody and Rust, not fired, but they agreed with them, the Bultmannians in general. But the seminary faculties condemned their incautious language. Frank Stagg, perhaps the most liberal professor in the denomination, faulted Clark for his failure to follow the realist approach. Stagg said, "I am for freedom, but surely we must be somewhat realistic about the people with whom we work. One cannot say all that he wants to say and be able to keep on talking." Bill Hull, who taught New Testament at Southern Seminary, felt the same way about Eliot. He affirmed Eliot's general framework of judicious scholarship and recognized that it was the prevailing approach in the seminaries. Nearly all the SBC biblical men are in this general tradition, Hull said. But Eliot's historical critical approach, Hull felt, was wholesome rather than injurious. And so to dismiss Eliot in light of this fact was practically a denial of the present reality of where the seminary faculties were. But nevertheless, Hull felt that Eliot was unwise in how he expressed his ideas and that his unguarded openness was a bit naive. Most seminary faculty judged that Clark and Eliot foolishly unveiled their liberal views. Most faculty preferred the tried and true realist approach. There were still some ways to promote liberal scholarship. Progressive Southern Baptists, for example, subscribed to Southern Seminary's quarterly journal, The Review and Expositor, and knew to watch the book review section for messages intended for the cognoscenti alone. When New Testament professor Bill Hull wanted to make some suggestions about the best means for advancing New Testament scholarship, and he wanted to do it free from the gaze of Southern Baptist anti-intellectuals, he placed his comments in the latter half of a book review on modern French and Belgian New Testament scholarship. He told President Duke McCall that, quote, "I like often to bury such comments in material that will be read only by those who need to see it." The seminary faculties duly noted the strong reaction to Eliot's views across the denomination and the fact that Midwestern's president and trustees had fired him. Duke McCall responded in 1962 that he heard on every hand warnings of the necessity of great caution in what the professor says. And he lamented that no theological professor will feel free to publish in the future. They could all identify with Louisiana College President G. Earl Gwynn's observations as a result of the denominational crackdown on liberalism. Gwynn said, "I can appreciate better than ever the old proverb, better is a live dog than a dead lion." Many times I am sure that even a dog must have trouble living with himself. They chafed under the restrictions of the realist policy, but they recognized that it was their only safety. The new purge in the seminaries reinforced the need of the realist policy. Conservative leader Herschel Hobbs told his fellow pastors that professors like Clark needed to be fired. They could not permit the seminaries to continue teaching heresy. And at the 1960 annual meeting of the Southern Baptist Convention, convention president Ramsey Pollard warned the seminaries in his convention sermon that Southern Baptists would not tolerate liberal preachers. C.C. Warren, the pastor of the First Baptist Church of Charlotte, North Carolina, and a leader of the conservatives in that state, did not understand why the seminaries resisted anchoring themselves to traditional orthodoxy. Warren said, in light of what we have gone through at Southern Seminary, it is incredible that seminary professors should still promote the results of their creative thinking. It was time for some leaders to make an effort to stem the tide, which seems to be running against the basic principles and tenets for which our forefathers verily gave their lives. Southern Baptist Seminary presidents, therefore, renewed their insistence that professors follow a realistic policy in their writing, teaching, and preaching. The dismissals of Clark, Elliott, and Southeastern Strickland, Oliver, and Briggs brought the lesson home powerfully. Theology professor Dale Moody told President McCall that many Southern Baptist professors wanted to debate traditional Southern Baptist views, but they refrained from doing so because they would either have to resign on account of their own beliefs, or else they would have to recant their beliefs in order to retain their positions. They are restrained, Moody said, by the pressures that prevail when one attempts to maintain his position in an institution and his reputation as a scholar. Some of the denomination's most progressive leaders abhorred the realist approach, as much for its lack of progress as for its compromises. McCall correctly judged, however, that the realist policy was the only viable means of promoting liberalism in the Southern Baptist Convention. And professors needed always to assess realistically their audience and the limits of their toleration. And the faculty who survived the purges of the early 1960s agreed. But by the end of McCall's tenure as president in 1982, the realist diplomacy was failing. The evidence of the liberalism on the faculties of the seminaries had become too great. McCall and his successor, Roy Honeycutt, could no longer persuade most Baptists that Southern Seminary was essentially Orthodox. And without that trust, the realist policy afforded the liberal faculty no protection. The denomination's conservative majority forced them out. Southern Seminary was the main source of the liberal ideas among Southern Baptists in the 20th century. Ironically, however, it was also the main source of the cure. The seminary remained a powerful symbol of orthodoxy even when liberalism was at its highest tide there. When Boyce and his fellow Baptists established Southern Seminary, they established it as a vanguard for the defense of historic orthodoxy. They led the seminary and the denomination to stand against the emerging liberalism. They planted a standard that has not fallen. Boyce dropped an anchor to hold Southern Baptists to the old orthodoxy. Even when that anchor seemed to have failed, the memory remained. The ideal that Boyce created in founding Southern Seminary continues still to shape Southern Baptist identity. Had Boyce, his colleagues, and supporters failed to establish Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in 1859, there is good reason to believe that Southern Baptists would not have been any more conservative than other Southern Protestants. Southern Protestants did remain more conservative in some ways than their Northern counterparts, but they followed the same liberal trajectory. Southern Baptists, however, ultimately repudiated that trajectory. They rejected the aspirations of theological development toward the liberal ideal. They rather insisted on a theological standard settled in the apostolic past. Boyce set orthodoxy at the heart of this institution's identity. He did this first by enshrining the seminary's confession, the abstract of principles, as the guarantee of orthodoxy. Second, he led the seminary to dismiss its jewel of learning, Crawford H. Toy, when Toy embraced liberal views. Finally, the memory of the heroic sacrifices of the founding faculty and their remarkable successes added considerable luster to Boyce's ideals. Theirs became the golden age of Southern Baptist memory, and their stand for orthodoxy reverberates still.